A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 225. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion of ghost stories for Christmas. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England. Hello.
We are continuing our annual look at stories from the A Ghost Story for Christmas run from the 1970s that is collected in a very nice box set. We are not covering them chronologically, but we are covering them two or three at a time. So last time, in the first half of our discussion this year, we were talking about the Stalls of Barchester and some things related to that. And this time we're going to add a different one.
Yes, that's right. We're looking at the third episode from the 1970s series from the BBC. It was broadcast on Christmas Day 1973, a story called Lost Hearts. And one of the sort of creepier, nastier stories, perhaps in some ways, as we'll get to in a moment.
Yes, and this series is a little unusual in that the episodes were annual. So you had one of these showing up around Christmas each year through the 70s, and they're quite neat in that way.
Yes, it's a fantastic idea from the BBC in the 70s to have this sort of annual bannered show, A Ghost Story for Christmas. So here we are with Lost Hearts in 1973. This one comes from the M.R. James story of the same name, which was published in his first collection of ghost stories entitled Ghost Stories of an Antiquary from 1904. And it's possibly one of James's more troubling stories, and it's has a reputation for a story that he didn't particularly like himself. It was one of his very earliest ghost stories that he wrote chronologically, and not one that he was altogether happy with in subsequent years.
Yes, that's right. It doesn't employ his common technique. We didn't quite have this in the Stalls of Barchester Cathedral that we were talking about last time either. But the common technique that M.R. James would often use would be that someone who is an archivist or an academic studying a strange old relic or book finds something and becomes involved with it somehow, and the strange events from the past happen in some way in the present as well with the person who is investigating it. That was something M.R. James used a lot, and he did it very effectively, but it didn't really play out that way in Lost Hearts. It has a very different kind of feel to it.
Yes, it does. It's, as we say, it's one of his more unusual stories with, as we say, a slightly troubling and disturbing theme.
Yes, absolutely. So the characters in this, there is a young orphan called Stephen, played by Simon Gibbs Kent, who arrives at this remote country house where his only surviving relative lives.
Yes, he's gone to live with his only surviving relative, an elderly cousin called Mr. Abney, who I believe describes himself as his cousin twice removed. Mr. Abney, played by the actor Joseph O'Connor, in a remarkably sort of sprightly, almost Dickensian character. He seems quite a humorous, jolly fellow. But he is also, he's a chap who's involved in some unusual studies of his own. And this is perhaps where we do get James touching on the academic, looking into things that he perhaps shouldn't do. And Mr. Abney, he seems delighted to have Stephen come live with him and is particularly interested in Stephen's age and in the health of Stephen's heart, and makes several inquiries about this. And at various points through the story, he comments about Stephen going out and getting exercise and this being good for the circulation and good for the heart and so on.
Yes, there are definitely creepy aspects to that character that come out through the course of the story. For the most part, Stephen is looked after by the butler, Parks, played by James Mellor, and also the housekeeper and cook, Mrs. Bunch, played by Susan Richards. So they become definitely part of the story and part of his world as well.
Yes, because although he has, Mr. Abney is interested in certain features of Stephen, he's not particularly interested in you know, his looking after him. And so it's mostly left to the staff, and as you say, particularly the kindly Mrs. Bunch, with whom he spends a lot of time chatting and talking about things and asking various questions about his elderly cousin, Mr. Abney. Is he a good man?
Yes, that's right. Now, as the story progresses, you get lots of sort of questions and strange things coming in. There are two sort of ghostly children that Stephen sees around the house and the grounds, and they seem quite strange and troubled and troubling to us.
Yes, and of course, Stephen, not knowing that he's a character in a ghost story, at first just sees them as two other children that perhaps he might be able to meet and play with, because otherwise he's surrounded only by adults. But of course, we spot the children straight away for what they are. And as their further appearances make clear, they are, well, their appearance is rather disturbing, and they are eerie figures.
Yes, for sure. And things are sort of in a downward spiral for poor Stephen.
Yes, because as we've said, Mr. Abney is up to something, and as the story progresses, we'll begin to get some clues as to what he's doing with his various researches. And along the way, there'll be various unpleasant encounters for Stephen as it heads towards its rather dark and ghastly conclusion to this story. It's a nasty one in a way, Brian.
Yes, it is sort of more grisly than most of M.R. James' works tend to be.
So we'll talk a little bit about the production of this particular episode from 1973. But first, we'll perhaps mention what you pointed out to me before we started recording, Brian, that this is not the first television adaptation of Lost Hearts. There was an earlier one, and it's from that series that we discussed before.
That's right. It's from Mystery and Imagination that we've gone to a couple times for our sort of more Halloween-themed episodes.
Sadly, it's one of the many, many lost episodes from that series. I believe it's from 1966 and the first series of Mystery and Imagination. But unfortunately, that one doesn't survive, so we can't watch it and compare it with this BBC version from 73.
Yes, there isn't a lot we can say about that adaptation, but it's interesting to know that they did it at that point in the 60s.
So we've got this time Lawrence Gordon Clark handing over the actual screenplay duties to a very well-known television writer, Robin Chapman, who has a long, illustrious history of television screenplays, including for us here on British Invaders. He actually did one episode of Doomwatch, which we've talked about, and he also wrote two of the episodes for the Jeremy Brett Casebook of Sherlock Holmes series. And I know you're a big fan of that series, Brian.
Yes, I am. Those were adaptations of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's original Sherlock Holmes stories. But certainly that series and also Doomwatch are both shows that are known for having good writing in them.
So here we are, Robin Chapman from those shows, and here he is adapting M.R. James's story for the television.
And once again, Lawrence Gordon Clark is directing, but this time he's not producing. Rosemary Hill takes over as producer. So it was interesting to see that when he decided that he would not adapt and direct and produce, that he wasn't going to do all three, the one that he decided to continue doing was the direction. And the production and writing/adaptation were handed off to others.
Yes, on the box set, when he does his interviews, you'll see that Gordon Clark actually during the rest of the year, he would be directing documentary programs, and he would just come back at Christmas to make these ghost stories. And as you say, Brian, here he is continuing as director, but leaving the screenplay to others. And of course, the start of his fairly successful relationship with the producer Rosemary Hill, who would carry on for the rest of this series.
Yes, that's right. And Lawrence Gordon Clark directed 7 of the 8 productions they did. It was only the final one that he wasn't involved with. It was shot on location at Harrington Hall in the misty flatlands of Lincolnshire, with the fog surrounding the house and all of this, a very spooky setting.
Yes, again, and Lawrence Gordon Clark talks about this on the DVD, that they'd planned this beautiful dawn shoot where they would have the horse and carriage that's bringing Stephen to the house coming in as the sun came up. But of course, when they turned up to do the filming, everything was covered in mist. And so the horse and carriage emerges from the fog to approach the house. And there you are, by happenstance, it does produce quite a remarkable effect. So again, we get this sort of seasonal shoot, giving us the features for our traditional fireside ghost story type tradition.
Yes, the misty look to it that they just happened to have there when they were shooting did work out very well for them.
And we should also mention that the production features some memorable music from an instrument called a hurdy-gurdy. And if you're not familiar with it, this is an instrument that you sort of wind up and play. And it does it pluck strings, Brian?
Well, there are some variations, but it's often bowed.
Ah, right. It does produce a sort of strange and disturbing sort of sound. I seem to remember that it's used in the movie Zodiac to great effect. And here it is in an earlier version in 1973, providing some of the background for this story, because one of the sort of ghostly children used to play the hurdy-gurdy. And in fact, his instrument still survives in the house, and Stephen is interested in it, and in particular in that the fact that he can hear the music coming from it from time to time.
It's an instrument that's often used for droning chord sound effects for the background of other things, but it can be used for other things as well.
So we have, as we've said, been rambling through this box set, a ghost story for Christmas from the BFI and the BBC. And if you've been following our episodes at this time of the year, each year, you'll notice that we've been sort of jumping around a little bit in time and not doing the stories chronologically, as we've said. We did discuss, I think, 2 of the recent revival stories last year when we did British Invaders 198 and 199. Where we did some more modern interpretations of the stories. But here we've jumped back to the 70s again, Brian.
Yes, that's right. We've now looked at 6 of the 8 stories that were done in the 70s. And it turns out, and this wasn't deliberate on our part, that we're looking at 2 of the darkest and sort of most vengeful types of stories in that run.
Yes, there's a theme of supernatural vengeance in both The Stalls of Barchester and in Lost Hearts. Yeah, so you can see some unexpected connections, which we found when we were looking at the 2 stories.
Yes, and if you've already seen A Warning to the Curious, which was the 2nd one that they did, these 2, the 1st and 3rd, have quite a similar look to that. There was sort of a common look and feel to it that changed over time, but it was fairly consistent for those first few. And in the first 2, we had Clive Swift playing Dr. Black as the character looking at and investigating these kinds of things, who is not a character that was created by M.R. James. It's just an unnamed narrator, perhaps M.R. James himself, written in the first person in the original stories.
So, yes, as you say, the look and feel of the first 3 shows, perhaps quite similar. In our last episode, we talked about the Stalls of Barchester, which had that memorably dark house with Robert Hardy sort of walking around, illuminated only by a candlelight, apparently, and the remarkable effects that produced. Here we've got some slightly more opened out landscapes. We've got the flat lands of Lincolnshire looking quite similar, I think, to the East Anglian landscape that we saw in A Warning to the Curious, that story that comes in between these two for the BBC. That was 1972's story. So you may see some similarities, certainly in the cinematography of it. A Warning to the Curious, of course, perhaps providing the perfect title for M.R. James's stories, which are about people looking into things that perhaps they should have left well alone, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. And they tend to be about things where people fall victim because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or had been curious and looked into something, dug something up that they shouldn't have. They tend to be things where the victims of ghostly things have not done very much, if anything, to deserve what happens to them.
So we've, as we've said, we've covered now six of the original eight BBC shows. And although we sort of said last time that we might try and rank and compare them, it's quite difficult to do that, I think, Brian, because they've all got, certainly the six we've looked at so far, they've all got something interesting about them to recommend them. And they've all got bits and pieces that make them worth looking at if you like a seasonal ghost story.
Yes, that's right. And they're very much things that were intended to be standalone. The fact that these were coming out once a year, not every week, is important, because this wasn't something that people were thinking about all the time, that you had just seen the last one. Each one was a standalone thing. They weren't being repeated that much, and they were just the thing that would come out that you would see a new one once each Christmas time.
Of course, as we've suggested, they are perhaps more straightforward adaptation of M.R. James stories, and none of them perhaps as controversial as the 1968 Jonathan Miller Whistle and I'll Come to You, which we keep referring back to, because that's a production which divides people, I think, Brian, and we talked about some of that when we discussed it ourselves.
Yes, that did sort of quite unusual things with that story. It was very different from the set of ideas that were in the original M.R. James story.
Yes, and Jonathan Miller suggests that perhaps there isn't a supernatural explanation for what's going on, that actually it's about the about an academic mind that's dissolving, which in a way I suppose is almost more scary as perhaps. And it's also a production that divides people as to whether it actually is boring to watch or scary to watch. But that's, as we say, that's something we discussed way back in the early episodes, so back in when we were in the 50s, Brian.
Yes, that's right. Yes, these two that we've been looking at these past couple of episodes are much more traditional interpretations of M.R. James. The only thing that was a significant shift from what is in the original text is the addition of Dr. Black in The Stalls of Barchester and that sort of framing story that was there.
Okay. So, here we have two fairly straightforward adaptations of M.R. James' stories, but from the BBC in the early 70s, and it's time for us to get into the good and the bad of each episode, as we've made up our own mind about them. So we're going to go back and start with The Stalls of Barchester. Where would you like to start, Brian? What did you like about that production?
I definitely want to talk about the look of it and how it was shot, because they got the spooky side of it, and the sort of lighting and the things by candlelight were very well done.
Yes, I mean, the way they've done that with Robert Hardy haunted in this house, and you know, the viewer sort of sharing his unease as we hear these noises off. It's quite well done. And the lighting, however it was achieved, is remarkable. And the focus right in on Hardy's face and leaving the actor to sort of tell us everything we need to know just by his facial expressions, it's brilliantly done. So for the first of these stories directed by Lawrence Gordon Clark, it's a remarkable job, I think.
Yes, it is. The moments in the stall itself when he gets a reaction touching these strange carved figures, and you see things happening there, and even when he's talking to someone, telling him about what they are, those things are quite well done and quite spooky as well. So that was quite neat.
Yes, they're very good. And of course, Norwich Cathedral itself lends an authenticity to the whole production. So another inspired choice to take the film in there and shoot in and around the cathedral itself. It looks the part perfectly, I think, Brian.
What do you think of the performances in this?
Well, I think the standout, obviously, is Robert Hardy, who... I don't think I've ever seen him, you know, in anything where he's disappointed me. He's always an interesting actor to watch, and I think he is very good indeed. Whether the surrounding performances are quite up to his standard, I'm not so sure. I mean, the actress who plays his sister, Letitia, perhaps she's meant to be slightly irritating because she does seem that way.
Right.
And some of the other minor characters, you know, perhaps less so. I'm not sure about the librarian's scenes with Dr. Black, although Clive Swift as Dr. Black is always fun to watch. What did you think of the actors?
I agree with you that that Robert Hardy was very good, and it sort of balances on his performance. The others I thought were okay. I didn't find any of them took away, you know, from what this should have been, but they were not drawing my attention in the same way. They were adequate, but they were not particularly strong.
Right.
What I will say on the more negative side with this is that the framing sequences with the librarian and Dr. Black didn't really go anywhere. They didn't seem to do much. And I was waiting for Dr. Black to somehow become more involved with the story, not realizing that he was a character who had been added to the story for the television version.
Okay.
It to me seemed that those framing moments didn't really need to be there.
We could have learned everything you needed to know from Robert Hardy's performance, probably.
Or from a more scaled back or something handled a little differently that was less present in the story, perhaps a narration.
Okay, that's an interesting way of looking at it, yes. The framing device does seem at times a little bit odd. But there you go. It is actually, you know, as we've said, it is from the story itself. But there we have the anonymous narrator, or James himself, who's doing the digging in the library and finding out these facts from these old documents.
Yeah, I didn't think it was as present in the story. It felt more like a narration to guide you through what was happening in the past, where it was a much more present sort of time-consuming chunk of the story in this case. It didn't ruin the production by any means, but it was something that was not as strong as it could have been. I think the addition of Dr. Black was more effective in A Warning to the Curious a year later than it was here.
Yes, I seem to remember in that one that he actually... he sort of takes more of a part in the story because he's discussing the events with the main character, Paxton. And I believe at one point he even spots the ghost himself when he's trying to do one of his paintings because he's on holiday painting, as I recall.
Yes, he is actually a character who goes out and does things in that one. And that was very much what the narrator did in that particular story.
Okay, that's interesting. We've talked about the marvellous sort of like direction and lighting, particularly of the interior scenes, and also that very cold looking location shoot in the wood where Robert Hardy appears to be freezing his assets for a good cause of acting to help with the atmosphere. We should point out that there is one there's one shot in this production which rather lets it down, I think, because it doesn't look very convincing, perhaps to our modern eyes. And that's the moment you may be familiar with when a hand rests on the Archdeacon's shoulder. And unfortunately, Brian, we have rather an obviously painted rubber glove trying to convince us it's some sort of scary hand of death or something.
Oh, yes, that's right. I think also our large televisions and high-resolution copies of things that we have now give us maybe more detail than we were intended to see in the 70s.
Yes, it probably does look worse on our modern big screens, and the transfer here to DVD looks particularly sharp, so it perhaps, maybe that's why it stands out to me, and why I thought perhaps an ordinary, just a plain old hand would have been scarier than the rubber glove.
But all in all, a strong production, I think.
Yes, it is. It's a very strong start for this series from the BBC and Lawrence Gordon Clark, very faithful to the M.R. James story, and all in all, as you say, very well done.
Indeed. So, Lost Hearts, what did you like about this one?
Well, again, I think we've got to talk a little bit about the locations and the look of this episode. A marvellous location in the Lincolnshire Fens with those misty mornings, this rather creepy old country house, Harrington Hall, that they found to shoot in. There's a lovely moment where the character Stephen is looking up at some stained glass windows, which appear to show these little cherubs, these little children looking down upon him. And that's very effective, particularly in view of the theme of the story. So I think, you know, the look of this episode, very good indeed, Brian. What did you think about it?
Yes, I agree. The look is definitely sort of the strength of this, with those locations and the makeup they used on the other children we see is quite impressive as well, I think.
Yes, when it comes to depicting some rather grisly effects, and let's sort of, you know, without giving too much away, the story is called Lost Hearts. So when they come to depict the Lost Hearts, it's quite well done. And I think perhaps the special effects here are... they're more successful than the hand in the Stalls of Barchester. And they're certainly more grisly, Brian.
Yes, and even the sort of drawn-out, ghostly faces of these children are pretty good.
The performances, what did you think here, Brian?
I thought they were pretty good. There was nothing that jumped out at me as being spectacular. The children were fine. They were good enough. Joseph O'Connor as Cousin Abney was better. He was pretty good. Yeah, all in all, they were good enough. There was nothing that really jumped out at me.
Okay. I did like Joseph O'Connor as the eccentric Abney. As I said, a sort of Dickensian character capering around. Again, in his introduction, Lawrence Gordon Clark spoke about how he'd asked Joseph O'Connor to give the character a sort of strange, jerky movement, recalling all the way back to the cabinet of Dr. Caligari was the reference he gave for the actor. So that's quite interesting. The child actors, perhaps, you know, as ever, they have the limitations of child actors that unless they are really very, very good, they can look a bit conscious in places. And I know that Lawrence Gordon Clark was very keen to try and get their performances sort of recorded pretty much in the first takes, because he found that the more they did it, the more conscious they became of the whole setup. So there are some moments when the children seem a little bit still or static, but on the whole, pretty good.
Okay. What did you think of the choice of this story of Lost Hearts itself?
Well, you have to say, you know, that it's a creepy story. It's one that's dealing basically with the murder of children and the supernatural vengeance thereof. So it's an interesting choice for the series. It's supposed to be a scary story, so, you know, it works in that effect. I would have preferred it if they'd gone with slightly less of the ghosts. I think the ghosts are perhaps too visible. In the Stores of Barchester, the atmosphere created by what we can't see is, I think, much better than when we actually have to see something on screen. Our imagination runs away with what Robert Hardy seems to be hearing in his house. And here, the rather visible ghosts, which are seen almost, you know, in the very first shot of Stephen arriving at the house, he sees the children waving at him from as he passes by in the carriage. So the ghosts themselves, very visible in this story, and I thought perhaps that less would have been more here. To see them less often would have been more effective.
Yes, that is a good point. We do have very visible ghosts that we see an awful lot in this particular story. I do find personally that Lost Hearts, while it clearly is a scary story, it is not as interesting a story as the Stalls of Barchester Cathedral or A Warning to the Curious or many of the others.
Yes, and as we've said, it's perhaps not the typical M.R. James story, and it's not one that he himself was particularly fond of. He didn't think it one of his best. So there you go. It's perhaps not the straightforward one, but if you know the story, you'll know what to expect here, and pretty much it's all there on screen for us.
Yes, indeed.
I should just mention, perhaps, I don't know how it came across on your TV, but I thought that the transfer here to DVD was slightly grainy in places on mine and didn't look quite as sharp as those rather magnificent shots of Robert Hardy in and around Norwich Cathedral.
Yes, I would agree with that, actually. That's true.
And maybe it's just the quality of the 16mm film that this was shot on. Who knows? But it's still, there it is, from 1973, from Christmas Day itself, no less. Quite a creepy story for Christmas Day. And here it is on this remarkable box set.
So let's get into our recommendations. Eamon, what would you say about the box set and these two stories in particular?
Well, I think clearly our listeners know that we're both big fans of this box set. If you've got any interest at all in seasonal story, ghost stories, or in the stories of M.R. James in particular, then it's one you have to have on your shelf. And you can do, as we do here on British Invaders, you can dip into it once or twice a year. And it's a remarkable source of entertainment. For these two stories, whether or not you should be watching them at Christmas this year, personally, I would say go for the Stalls of Barchester. That's the, I think, the more interesting of the two. I think it's the better produced on screen. It has that remarkable central performance by Robert Hardy. So for me, if I was recommending to our listeners one to look at over this holiday period for your dose of seasonal chills, I would go for the Stalls of Barchester from 1971. So, Brian, what about yourself? How would you go with this box set and these two episodes?
I pretty much agree with that. The box set itself is very strong. There's a lot of good stuff in it. The Stalls of Barchester and Lost Hearts are both good. They're both worth watching. I would tend to say that the Stalls of Barchester is the better one. I think I prefer A Warning to the Curious to either of these. My tendency would be, if you were to do two stories for Christmas time, to start with those first two, the Stalls of Barchester and A Warning to the Curious, and you'll have two very good stories there, and you even have the Dr. Black character showing up in both of them. Lost Hearts is good. I probably wouldn't pair it with The Stalls of Barchester because they're both quite dark and intense. But it is worth watching at some point as well. But yeah, I would say that The Stalls of Barchester is the stronger one.
Okay. The pairing of the two Dr. Black stories is a good one. And certainly that would be one to look at this Christmas. For myself, I think I'm tempted to go back to Jonathan Miller's 1968 Whistle and I'll Come to You. Just talking about it has made me interested to go back and look at that again. It's fascinating how this box set reintroduces new generations to the stories of M.R. James and to this rather interesting series from the BBC in the 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. So, in summary, A Ghost Story for Christmas was an annual event on the BBC throughout most of the 1970s. And many of the stories that were adapted were written by M.R. James in the early 20th century. And these have fairly faithful adaptations that were done by the BBC. In this case, The Stalls of Barchester, which dealt with this archdeacon who had these strange carvings at his seat, at his stall in the cathedral, which gave very strange and ghostly things that happen that lead to a rather unpleasant fate in the case of many people holding that position. A couple years later, Lost Hearts was released, which dealt with young children and an older character who was dealing with these children and some rather brutal things that would happen and some unpleasant supernatural events as well. And the second of these two stories we're looking at both being quite dark and vengeful in a supernatural way.
Splendid stuff. And as ever, if you've seen these two episodes, or if you have your own particular favourite episode from this box set, please come along to the Facebook group, join in the fun, and let us know what you think.
Absolutely.
And of course, please come back and join us next time as we get to our first shows of 2016, and we turn our attention to a show called Time Trumpet. It's from 2006, and it takes the form of a look back at our own society from the future. It's an amusing show with lots of sort of well-known current comedians involved. So it's a sort of comic look back at our own society.
Yes, and a set of predictions of what would happen in the following years as well.
Splendid stuff. Something to come back for next time.
But before that, you can find us at BritishInvaders.com, or you can join us on our Facebook group. If you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. And we have lots of good discussions going on.
Or you can listen to British Invaders and several other fascinating geek-related podcasts at the Voice of Geeks streaming radio network. That's at vognetwork.com, where, you, as I say, you'll find British Invaders on a Monday and Tuesday, but you'll find several other shows. Come along and give some of them a try.
Yes, absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. And until next time, it's Eamon in England suggesting that you draw near the fireplace as we wish you happy holidays from the bottom of our lost hearts.